Welcome back to the Cyclist Magazine podcast. I'm your host, James Spender, and with me today, and I have to say this because he pays my wages, he employed me, he picked me, plucked me from obscurity 12 years ago, a highly esteemed, highly acclaimed, very wise editor of Cyclist Magazine and overlord of cyclists in its entirety, Mr. Pete Muir.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a gushing intro, I would say there, James.
Absolutely. Well, like I say, we're all looking to Christmas bonuses, looking to the future, looking to pay rises. So hopefully it can't hurt. But in all seriousness, it is lovely to have you here sitting opposite me virtually, of course. We don't get each other all that much. But it's also lovely, I hope, for listeners to hear the voice of the man that makes the magazine. And maybe to ask you, Pete, just for a couple of highlights, because we've just put issue 152 to bed. I say just, it's probably been in the shops maybe for a week or so. What has stuck out to you as some of your top stories for the last issue of Cyclist?
This issue of Cyclist that's out, the big ride for this, you know, we do our big rides every month. We try and find new and exciting places to ride. And this one, we sent our intrepid reporter, Emma Cole, to Nice, in the south of France, on the coast. And why there? Well, partly because it's just a lovely place to ride a bike. It's not only a city that's just very well set up for cyclists, but it's nestled in the foothills of the Alps. So you don't need to ride too far out of town before you're into some amazing scenery. More importantly, though, Nice has a rather special place in this year's cycling calendar, because it's going to be the final stages of this year's Tour de France, for the first time ever. So in the hundreds of years that the Tour de France has been going, every year that it has been on, it has ended up in Paris on the Champs-Élysées, of course, very famously, but not this year. I think it's quite exciting. I think when Emma went there, what she discovered was not only a lovely place to ride, but a city that's plainly gearing up for something quite exciting. She said there's huge billboards with, you know, countdown time was going, only X days until the tour arrives. When it gets there, there's going to be big crowds, there's going to be a huge party atmosphere. And that made me think, hang on a sec, why don't they do this more often? Maybe every couple of years the tour goes, right, we're going to finish the tour in a different city. We'll go back to Paris in the intermediate years, but for every second year we'll find a new city to do it in. I think London, or maybe Manchester or Newcastle or Glasgow again.
Well, yeah, as I can't take credit for this. As you pointed out in a chat we had the other day, somewhere like Rome, if you had it finishing at or around, they could do laps of the Colosseum in a true kind of crit racing fashion, which could actually mean something. And that's the other thing about this year's last stage finishing Nice, is it's a time trial as well. And that is always a really exciting proposition. It hasn't happened since 1989. I was five. Pete was even younger, I think. There's another vote for my pay rise. And it obviously elicited a monumentally momentous result, and it could do again. I think if you twin those two things together, if you had an Arrivé that finished in a big world city with an incredible backdrop, then you also had some element of it that had just even a tinge of it could actually affect the overall GC result. I'm not saying that everyone should race 20 stages and it kind of comes to naught because there's some wacky races thing at the end that just, you know, dismisses all other results. But at the same time, to have a kind of genuine climax that isn't just a procession is amazing. But there was one thing, and what do you think about this? If you're Mark Cavendish, and, you know, who knows whether Cav's even going to make it to the tour. We think he is, but he's had a pretty poor start to the season in terms of his health. If you're Cav, are you feeling a bit shortchanged that potentially your last outing, irrespective of whether or not you get that elusive stage, hopefully get to the end, but it's not going to finish on the Champs-Élysées? You're not going to get that moment in front of the Arc de Triomphe where you stand on the podium and you get untold adulation from the crowds and Christian Prudhomme presents you. You're in Nice, lovely and nice, but it's not the Champs. What do you think?
Well, like every second year, so if you're Mark Cavendish, you might be thinking, well, this is my retirement year. It has to be on the Champs-Élysées where I get my last hurrah. But, you know, it's Mark Cavendish. He'll just come back the following year. like he's always done. He'll just go, oh yeah, did I say I was retiring? Maybe one more year. What's that you say? Champs-Élysées in 2025? Okay, I'll be there.
Well, on that note, It's a wonderful segue into our guest today, because it's somebody else who is going to be, hopefully he'll be cruising with that champagne, I'm not sure quite where they finish, but into Paris. It's Krishnan Gurumurthy, who is a friend of the show. He's been on before. He is riding this year's Duchenne Dash again, which is a ride very close to his heart. He's the patron and founder of, which raises money for the Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy Charity. It's taking place on the 17th and 18th of May. So you can see our show notes for how you can get involved, how you could sponsor Krishnan, or even go and ride it yourself. I'm not sure if there still might be places left or looking to ride it next year, because it is an annual bash. So it's London to Paris in 24 hours is the Duchenne Dash. So let's welcome to the show Krishnan Gurumurthy. So Krishnan, welcome to the Cyclist Magazine podcast, or welcome back. I think we can almost call you a friend of the podcast, if that's not slightly overstepping. But eagle-eyed listeners will remember that Krishnan came on a few years ago to talk about the Duchenne Dash, which is happening again this year. And also just to talk about cycling, because as much as you are Channel 4's premier news anchor, newscaster, and one of the biggest in the UK, also, you do like cycling a bit, because the Duchenne Dash is fairly difficult. It's riding to Paris in 24 hours. You've got to like cycling to be able to do that, right?
No, absolutely. Thank you for having me back. You've got to like cycling for a bit. I'm a sort of a weird cyclist in that I'm not sort of around the year cyclist. And I don't think of myself as somebody who always enjoys cycling, but I go through periods of my life where I enjoy cycling and do a lot of it. I'm a really bad weather cyclist at the moment. I'm easily put off by bad weather. But now that the weather is changing, it's encouraging me more.
So would you say that you're somebody that has a lot of technical fibres in your wardrobe? Have you got a lot of Gore-Tex, a lot of long bib tights, but you're not necessarily wearing them because you look outside and it's raining? Or are you literally just like, I only go out when it's sunny?
I've got to that point recently where I'm a little bit, I only go out when it's sunny, but I obviously know that that can't be maintained because I've got to get back properly into training for the Dash. I do have quite a lot of technical fibers, but they're all really old. I haven't bought anything for years. I went through that phase of buying loads and loads of stuff, but I haven't bought anything for years. I bought a new bike, but I haven't bought any clothes to wear on it.
What's the bike?
Well, it's a sort of a prototype, actually. It's a one-off. It's called an On and Off, and it's an e-road bike made by Pearson. And I used it last year to sort of get me over some hills, and I liked it so much I bought it. And then I got fit because I did Strictly Come Dancing, and I don't need it anymore. So this is the second time I bought an e-road bike and then got fit and not needed it anymore. I'm a very, very bad buyer of bikes.
So, Krishnan, are you planning on using your e-road bike for the Duchenne Dash? Because that sounds a little bit like cheating.
Like a cheat. Well, actually, no. I was going to. I mean, basically, I got to the point with the Dash where I quite often ride it just to be there. And sort of to chat to people along the way and sort of encourage people. And so I have done it on a e-road bike before, a couple of times, partly because I've got a heart condition that means that I've got to be very careful about spikes in my heart rate. So I would use it just to sort of iron out my heart rate and make sure that it doesn't go into the red zone. But I'm in reasonably good shape now, so I think I'm not going to use it. And I'm kind of wondering what to do with it. I kind of bought it because I thought I'd commute on it, and then I've been rubbish because it's been really, really wet and cold. So now I think I will commute on it now that the sun is out today for the first time, and I was thinking about using it to just go into work after we do this podcast.
And the last time you were on, it was just after lockdown, and the Duchenne Dash was quite a new thing. How has your cycling life changed from that? Are you more into the cycling?
I'm really faddish about my cycling. I think when I first got into cycling, it was 12 years ago when we did the first Dash, actually. And I became very nerdy about it, and I was very much all the gear and no idea. And I bought loads of technical clothing and lots of accessories and a bike computer and then another bike computer and a trainer and all that kind of stuff that they sell to you and tell you you need, and then didn't really use half of it and realized that cycling is really just about getting out there. And so I'm when I say I'm faddish, I do go through little moments. My last little moment of cycling a lot was actually in Australia over Christmas. My wife is Australian, so we go to Australia every year. And I did quite a lot of cycling around the Mornington Peninsula with my brother-in-law, who's a keen cyclist. And that was great fun. And it is just about nice views and feeling good. And it really does feel so much easier when I'm feeling healthy. And I'm a sort of very up and down person in terms of my physical confidence. But because I've spent the last 6 months in and out of Strictly Come Dancing, I'm relatively physically trim. So I'm feeling a lot more confident.
So, I mean, I don't want to stray too far away from the subject of cycling, but just on the Strictly chat, I'm really interested with shows like that. How much time do you actually end up dedicating to said show? Because obviously you're still being a full-time Channel 4 presenter, and I'm sure that your schedule became a bit more flexible, but are you there, you say 6 months, you know, or a couple of months, are you there kind of every single day getting drilled, training?
When I was doing the show, the TV show, I say it's 6 months because that 6 months is sort of the time from when I said yes to when I exited the whole thing. But when you're doing the show, it's really, really full on. And I'm no longer a full-time TV news person. I'm very much part-time. I'm doing between 6 and 8 hours of dancing a day or training. I would train around the corner from Channel 4 News, and I'd be in the studio from about 9 a.m. till about 3 p.m. And then I'd go over to the news, do the news until 8, and then go back to the dance studio at about 8:30, do about another hour and a half, and then go home at 10, 10:30. So that's a very, very full-on regime when you're actually in the TV show, because you're giving it absolutely everything and you're desperately trying to stay in. Once the TV show ends, you then go into the tour process, which is optional, and you don't have to do it, but I did it. And because how many times are you going to be asked to play the O2 in your life? And then it's very weird because it's a bit like doing a pantomime. You're doing a show once or twice a day because you do matinees in different parts of the country for a month, and you don't do anything during the day because once the show is set, you just turn up an hour before you go on stage and you do the show, and then you might do it again if you've done an afternoon show and then an evening. So that's about it. But it means that you do feel on top of your game by the end of that process, and your legs are very high definition, if that's the word.
Everybody who does Strictly says, oh, I'm going to keep dancing. I'm never going to stop doing this. Are you doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's really, really hard to carry on dancing because when you're on Strictly, you are dancing with one of the world's best dancers in amazing facilities for hours and hours every day. And you learn really, really quickly. You also learn a routine. You're not really learning to dance. You're learning a routine. So you're not learning any of the rules of dancing or, you know, how to do it to any music at any time with any dancer partner. You're just learning how to perform 90 seconds on a Saturday night. So it's very, very difficult to carry that on. You know, you wouldn't want to go to a weekly class in a group after that because I think it would feel very slow. I am thinking of taking some private lessons with a friend of my dance partner who might be able to teach me more in a sort of a Strictly way. So we'll see. It kind of depends on time. I'd like to, if possible, because it feels like a bit of a waste to learn all that stuff and then just let it go. But I don't think I'll be going along to sort of the weekly class at my local dance centre.
Not going to the salsa nights at the pub?
No, I think I've got to find some other way of doing it if I'm going to.
Which, comparing experiences on the bike with Strictly, which put you more out of your comfort zone, give you a higher spike of adrenaline and anxiety, lining up for the beginning of the first Douche and Dash 12 years ago, which is 300 miles, or what's that, 720 Ks in French money, all the way over to Paris in 24 hours. That's, sorry, 480K, by the way, not 720.
Actually, no. the way we do it, because we go New Haven, Dieppe.
Right.
So it's actually 200 miles, 300K.
Okay. So anyway, Big undertaking.
Still a long way.
Still a very long way. First time you've done it, what's more anxiety-inducing? Wondering whether or not you'll find yourself in a nice brasserie in 24 hours' time having a pint, or whether or not you're going to trip over in the first show in Strictly, or even just tread on the feet of your dance partner that first time out in the studio.
Quite similar levels of stress and fear, I would say. Different levels of adrenaline, strictly because it's a TV show, very, very high adrenaline levels and very high jeopardy because you've got to try and stay in it each week. But the first time I got on the bike and decided I was going to do the dash and started going on training rides, I remember being absolutely terrified because I'm not a physically fit person normally, and I was really quite overweight and not very strong. And so going up hills for the first time in the Surrey Hills was absolutely petrifying. I remember, you know, in the snow, you know, heading down towards, I'm trying to think what that terrible, Leith Hill.
Yeah.
The first time we went to Leith Hill, I just remember being absolutely terrified, going, there's absolutely no way I'm going to be able to do this. And it took me quite a long time. I mean, to be honest, it was only after I'd done the whole trip to Paris once that I realised I can do this. And I think the climbing on to Paris is about 3,000 metres over the whole stretch, the way we go. And, you know, you're tired at the end of that. Your legs hurt. And and it's difficult. So, yeah, I mean, I remember being really, really scared by the prospect of trying to do it. And then once you've done it once, of course, you know you can do it again. Although now I'm getting older and older, obviously, it's not easy. And doing it when you're 42, I think I was when I first did it, and then doing it when you're 54 this time is a different prospect, despite all that stuff about older, fitter, faster, which I'm not sure is true.
Yeah, Christian, I'm aware that we're talking about the Duchenne Dash here, but there will be people who don't actually know what it is. Perhaps you could quickly talk us through it, you know, what it is, how it came about and your role in it.
So the Duchenne Dash is a 24-hour bike ride from London to Paris. And it was started 12 years ago when I decided to try and raise some money for a new charity launched by a colleague of mine on Channel 4 News, whose son was diagnosed with a rare form of muscular dystrophy called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's a really, really cruel disease. It's a muscle wasting disease, and it affects boys overwhelmingly because of the genetics of it. And what it means is that from a relatively young age, you start noticing it when they're two or three, that they are slower to walk, can't run as much, that they degenerate. And often boys with Duchenne will be in wheelchairs by the time they are 10, 11, 12. Things get steadily more difficult as they get older. There are some drugs that can help them a little bit and some therapies that can help them a little bit, but there is no cure at the moment. And so they end up paralyzed, and the disease ends in death and an early death. And so there was no charity that was dedicated to medical research in those days, just medical research. And so that's what Emily decided to do. Emily Crossley, who runs the charity. And the idea was to try and get research that was in the lab into medical trials, because in those days that was the big challenge. Now, you know, as with all medical things, the landscape changes very, very quickly. And now there is lots of drug development and therapy development going on with Duchenne, particularly in gene therapy, because this is a genetic disease and people are looking at different ways of switching off the genetic problem that causes it. And they're doing that with all sorts of ingenious ways that edit genes effectively or turn things off. So, you know, real progress and real, you know, big steps, you know, are very much in sight now. And when we started this, we had the aim of ending Duchenne in 10 years, because that was roughly what it took to come up with effective treatments for HIV or drugs to manage HIV. We haven't quite managed it in 10 years, but we are, you know, we're close now. I think it feels like we're close. And so the great thing about the Duchenne Dash is it has a lot of repeat business, because people really buy into the idea behind it and what it is we're trying to do. So we have lots of people who've done it, you know, more than once. We have a very small number of people who've done it every single year since it started, and who raised a lot of money. And you know, we started, the first year I did it, I was just going to do it with a couple of people from work. And then I spoke to a couple of people I was interviewing. I interviewed the head of Google, Matt Britton, in Britain, and he is a cyclist himself. And we filmed him going to work on his bike. And I started talking to him about the fact that I just bought a new bike and I was doing this ride. And the next day he rang me and said, could I join you and maybe bring a few friends on it? And so it grew as a group of people, from just a couple of people on Channel 4 News to some people from Channel 4, from Google, from Twitter, and a couple of other sort of just random friends. And there was 32 of us, and we raised £250,000 between us. Since then, it's kind of grown into a much bigger event. We take about 140 cyclists plus support. So it's about 160 on the ride, because we have ride captains leading the groups. And it's an incredible thing. You know, we've raised over £1 million some years, and we're trying to get back up to that level now. Fundraising, I think, post pandemic and with cost of living crisis has been tough on all these kinds of events, but we are trying to get back up there.
I feel like these sorts of events attract people with some often really amazing stories. Is there any stories, any people that you've met on rides, on the Dash rather, which have really struck you and stayed with you?
Well, I mean, the Dash is often ridden by parents of boys with Duchenne, and they are incredible people, and often, you know, like me, not cyclists at all, and go out on this endeavor to do something, to achieve something physical, and also to persuade people to give them money. I mean, my sort of rationale on doing the Dash was always, people know how unfit I am and how much this will hurt, therefore they will give me money. When you're dealing with parents who are living this absolute nightmare of grief, you know, all the time, because you're grieving what you know you're going to lose at some point in time, and trying to keep up hope, trying to do the best in terms of getting treatment and therapy for your child, trying to adapt your home so that your child, who is walking now but might be in a wheelchair next year and might be effectively bedbound in the future, you know, it's constant, really, really difficult process of adjusting to what the disease does to you and the effect on your family as well. Because, you know, a lot of people have got other children and they're trying to raise those children as normally as possible, if you like, within a very abnormal setting. It's really inspiring seeing how people manage their lives. You know, I think I have a sort of a busy life, and I travel a lot, and I've got lots of plates spinning at the same time, and I do lots of different things, and I'm involved with a couple of different charities, and you kind of think of yourself as really busy, and then you look at these people and what they're trying to juggle and what they're trying to achieve in you know, keeping their children and their families happy in this desperate situation is just incredible. And they are, you know, a lot of them are happy. I mean, Emily, the founder of the charity, her son Eli is the same age as my son, and they're now 16. They're mates, they play in a band together. Eli's the singer, and he plays ukulele as well. And they just achieve amazing things. They played Glastonbury last year. Wow. Eli is in Texas, I think, as we speak, playing South by Southwest. Amazing festivals. And so I guess you just have these, when people know that they don't have the same time as the rest of us, I guess there's more of an incentive to achieve and enjoy life while it's there.
Yeah. Do you feel, essentially, as someone who is not only at the top of their profession, but ostensibly a celebrity in a sense, you know, you have a soapbox. Do you feel it's important for you to use that for the promotion of something like the Duchenne Dash, or for, you know, it just to take people who might not have a voice and to raise them up? Is that something that you see as a role for someone like you in society?
Yeah, it's really difficult when you do the news, because you've got to be impartial. So you've got to be very careful about what you back and the campaigns you get behind. I couldn't get behind most campaigns because they are political in some form. But I decided that I was going to basically put all my fundraising energy into one charity, which would be the Duchenne UK charity, and focus everything on that, because that way I could really concentrate profile. So every time I go on a celebrity quiz or something on the TV that's about raising money, I will always say it's about Duchenne, because the more mentions I can give it in public platforms, the more profile it raises. Most people haven't heard of rare diseases, and they haven't heard of things like Duchenne. So the more times that they hear that word on the telly or on the radio or on podcasts like this, the better. And so, yeah, I have decided to try and do that as much as I possibly can. And giving people a voice is what we do on the news, and what we try and do, because we try and tell people stories and give them the platform to explain what they're up against. So yeah, I mean, if I can do that in my life away from the news as well, then all the better. And I think that's what we've also found with Duchenne, that because we got involved in this charity when the boys I knew with Duchenne were very, very young, we were doing all the talking and we were doing all the awareness raising. As they get older, as I say, Eli, who's 16 now, is incredibly eloquent. He can really speak for himself. And you do feel as though you are, putting it more in their hands. And I think that's a really important thing, and letting them have their say and tell the world about their lives. And I think that's maybe a shift in charities in general. That we don't want to be saviors speaking for the people we're trying to help. We want to try and get them to speak for themselves and give them the platform, give them the microphone as much as possible.
And along the same lines, you must work with and talk with a lot of very influential people. Are you trying to persuade them to join the Duchenne Dash? Have you got any of your colleagues? Is Jon Snow doing it this year?
John's not doing it this year. He has come and done sections of it. We've had some supporters over the years who aren't able to do the whole thing because it's quite a time commitment, but will maybe come for the final section. I do spend quite a lot of time trying to persuade people to do it. I was going to try and get some of the Strictly boys to do it, and they were quite keen, but the dates this year don't quite work, because the Duchenne Dash this year is on May the 17th until the 18th. It's Friday into the Saturday. And the Strictly Lotter on tour still then, so they're not able to do it. But yeah, I mean, pretty much everyone I talk to, there's always a sort of, if you fancy joining us, then you'd be very welcome.
And if anyone listening to this wants to get involved, what do they do?
Absolutely, yeah. I think there are still places available on the Dash, and we always end up full, but it's quite often, quite late in the day that we fill it. So if you do want to get involved, then you can go to the Duchenne UK website, which is duchenneuk.org, or just Google Duchenne Dash, and it will take you to the website, and you sign up, and there is an entry fee, so that all the money that we raise in sponsorship goes to the good cause. And we do have quite a lot of sort of big sponsors there as well who help pay for it. What I would say is it is the best supported ride you will have ever done. I know there are loads of sort of sponsored rides out there. The Duchenne Dash is quite a luxurious ride. We've got amazing support, amazing support vehicles. We have this brilliant dinner when we get to Paris, in a restaurant overlooking the Eiffel Tower. And the whole thing is just great fun. Everybody who does it has an amazing time. And it's that thing where you've got CEOs of big companies, you've got parents of people who've got the disease, you've got people who are just inspired by it, and some high-profile supporters, some just, people who might have heard something or read something and decided that they want to do a physical challenge. So it's a really nice mix of people.
And you said yourself that you had your 10-year limit. You've gone beyond that. Is it just going to keep rolling until such time as you've either achieved your ambitions or until you decide you can't do it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, the science is going in leaps and bounds and is making huge amounts of progress. But also the charity has changed slightly in terms of its ambition. And I should say I'm the chairman of the charity now as well, so I'm much more involved with it than I ever was. But as well as funding medical research and getting involved in medical trials, which is one of the big things that Duchenne UK has really changed the landscape on, because getting people with the right set of circumstances into the right place so that they can take part in medical trials has always been a bit of a challenge with rare diseases. But we're also looking at ways of making life better for people with Duchenne. So we are looking at things like improving wheelchairs. We're looking at a suit, a sort of a smart suit, like an exoskeleton that we are trying to develop with outside partners, where people with Duchenne could wear a sort of an exoskeleton that would help them maintain muscle function for certain things for much longer. Because as your muscles weaken, you might not be able to pick a glass up and drink by yourself, but with a little bit of electronic help, you might be able to. And obviously with advances in technology and artificial intelligence, all of these things are coming a little bit closer to within grasping distance. So yeah, the charity is kind of spreading out as well in terms of what it wants to achieve. And so we will just carry on for as long as we are able. I don't know how long I'll be able to carry on doing the bike ride, but I mean, there will come a time when I can't. But having said that, the oldest person who has done the bike ride is Terry Burns, who is the former chairman of Channel 4, Lord Burns. And I think he did it when he was 71 or 72. So, you know, I've got a few years of me yet, I guess.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that Cyclist isn't just a podcast. No, Cyclist is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist magazine subscription offers. I wonder this about newsreaders particularly, because you're present, but you're almost supposed to not kind of be there. Like you say, you can't bring a bias. You're not necessarily supposed to be the kind of adversary. Are you kind of like well known in your neighbourhood and your street? Do you have people doorstepping you from other media outlets wanting to get stories?
No. I mean, obviously, all the people who live around me know who I am and what I do, and they might say hello or have a chat about something that's interesting them. But as far as privacy and other media outlets and that kind of thing, I mean, I kind of always find that if you are fairly sensible about it, then it's not a huge problem. I mean, when I was doing Strictly is an incredibly high profile thing, and I never really realised when I signed up how big a deal it was. But as soon as you start doing it, you realise, yeah, you know, you go through a period of time where loads of people want to talk about it, loads of people want a picture or a selfie or whatever it is, but it's pretty short-lived, you know, and once it's over, you kind of go back to normal. And yes, there were a lot of paps taking pictures of us wherever we were, but not at home, because I would always make sure that if somebody wanted a picture, they would get it outside my office or on the high street, or, you know, much, much better to stop on the street outside a shop than for people to go, we still haven't got a decent picture of him, could just go around to his house.
Yeah.
So actually, I've never been bothered at home. The only time I've had a minor hassle at home was on my 50th birthday, which was during lockdown, the first lockdown. And I think a couple of enterprising journalists thought, I bet he's going to have a rule-breaking party. So they sent a photographer down to my road. And fortunately, I wasn't having a rule-breaking party, but I did go out and get some food from a restaurant. And when I brought it back, my daughter said, there's a man down there behind the tree taking pictures of you, Dad. and it's like, oh, right, okay. Well, we know what that's about.
With that journalist hat still on, just thinking, one of the questions that Pete and I get asked most, because we're cycling journalists, is what's the best bike, or what bike should I buy? When someone sees you in the street and they know you as a political broadcaster, what question comes up most?
I mean, the question you probably get asked the most is, what do you really think yourself? And it's the one you can't answer, and you always say, "Oh, I can't really answer that one." And obviously, my closest friends and family get a good sense of what I think about the world, but I can't share those sorts of things with people in the street, because you know, I've just got to be careful of what I say in public.
Do you need to remain impartial beyond work, as it were?
I mean, I don't have to, but I think you'd be very unwise not to, because it'll get out. And if you say things in a private setting, I don't know where the line is anymore. You know, once you've been on telly as long as I have, and people kind of know who you are, if somebody hears me in a cafe saying something very political or, you know, a particularly controversial opinion, then all they need to do is tweet, oh, I'm sitting in a cafe and Krishnan Guruamurthy just said X, and it's suddenly public, and then it's part of my job. So yeah, I mean, I think you just have to, when you do my job, you just sort of sign up to basically saying, I'm not going to take part in public debate. And if there is a relatively small number of my closest friends from school and university with whom I do discuss all of these things, and they all know what I think about the world, but it's a very small number of people.
Does it feel, however, that at the moment, with news outlets are becoming increasingly partial, if you want to even put it that way. So GB yeah. News, these people got very opinionated. A lot of news is going out over YouTube. Does it feel like you're becoming an increasingly smaller circle of people who are obliged to maintain that impartiality, and that actually it's kind of unfair now?
I don't know if it's unfair. I mean, yes, the landscape is changing, and you've now got very opinionated broadcasters and channels basically taking sides, and there is a small number of us who are the old public service broadcasters who are, you know, vehemently saying impartiality matters, and it's really important that the maximum number of people still trust us and trust that we are trying our best to be fair to everyone. And so that's why we try it, because I just kind of, personally, I find opinionated channels boring because I know what everyone's going to say. And if I know the opinion of the interviewer and I know the opinion of the interviewee, then nothing's going to surprise me about this interview. It's just going to be two people either having a massive fight or agreeing with each other. So I would always much rather watch, you know, skillful interviewers surprise me with a conversation and try and represent as broad a spread of people as possible. You know, in my interviews, you can't do this in all the time, but you will sometimes try and attack from one side and sometimes attack from another, and you might do the same thing in the same interview. And that's what your job is, because you're trying to, you don't want, you know, if you're attacking from the right, you don't want everybody from the left to say, but what about this? You then want to go, well, the other way of looking at it is, you know, from that way. So I don't like opinionated TV. I think it's kind of boring, and I don't think it's providing a good service. I think it divides people more than they already are, and that's not what we need at the moment. It also gives politicians an easy way out of doing the harder interviews, because it's easy for them to choose their friends and the people who support them. And we see that right now. The government's all over GB News all the time because they see it as a friendly, supportive place, and they come on the public service broadcasters a lot less. And, you know, I don't know if there's a Labour government, there might be a sort of a lefty channel that becomes more mainstream, and you might have the same problem there. You know, who knows? It doesn't look like that's going to happen at the moment, because I think, you know, history tells us that it tends to be the right-wing channels that are commercially prosperous in America, and that's what people have tried to replicate in this country. And GB News is doing all right. You know, there's a certain number of people who want that, and it's probably enough to sort of sustain one channel. It turns out that it wasn't enough to sustain two. You know, Talk TV has had to come off TV and go online. So it's a limited market, but I don't think it's an especially good thing.
So in order to kind of like maybe bring some kind of balance to the kind of broader landscape, do you feel, you know, and this is kind of calling back to something we touched on earlier, do you feel it's important to do the public a service by asking specific people specific questions? Because you know, particularly I'm sure from a kind of insider's point of view, perhaps more of the truth than maybe people know in through the media, because of the way that the media is filtered and the way that spokespeople filter the words of politicians and everyone else. So you know you need to go for the jugular and you've got a kind of chess game in your head. I'm going to ask this question. They're going to say this. Then I'm going to drill on that. And then I'm going to have them on the ropes. And that's when we can really get the truth, because I know what the truth is, but I can't just say it. I need them to say it.
Well, it's not that I know the truth more than anyone else. I mean, but I do game my interviews. Yeah, I mean, I do think them through and think, well, if I say this, he's going to say that, and then I can move there. So it is a bit like a game of chess. It is my job to, in part, to sort of represent the viewer and ask the questions that people at home are thinking, but it's also to sort of try and reveal as much as possible. And so if I think there is a truth that is not necessarily in general circulation because no one else has quite got to that yet, then yeah, I will try and highlight that point. You know, if there's a particular spin operation around a particular type of argument and you kind of want to puncture it to say, well, actually isn't the truth X, then yeah, you have to be sort of quite insistent about that. And I think that is our job. I think the difficulty is, as I was saying before, is you've got to try and represent as many different points of view as possible over a period of time. And so, because you want everybody to feel that there is something in it, you don't want just one lot of people to come to you. And Channel 4 is a tricky one, because we do have a particular mission on Channel 4 to represent underrepresented groups. And so that means young people, migrants, you know, different cultures, and different ways of thinking. And so that can make some people think, well, then, you are inherently taking sides. And so we have to be quite careful, I think, to sort of say, well, actually, no. I mean, we do have those particular interests across the channel, but basically the point of Channel 4 is to look at views and places that aren't really covered adequately elsewhere. And so that does mean sort of, you know, minority views on the left and the right of the argument. So it's not an easy one, but yeah, we just try and be fair. You know, it's an art, not a science. And, you know, you try and think as broadly as possible.
You mentioned that sometimes it feels a bit like a game, that, you know, you're trying to get the answers out of someone, a politician perhaps, and they're trying to present their own agenda or avoid those particular questions. Do you have a kind of post-match analysis? Once the cameras are off, do you actually find yourself, you know, analysing it and saying, who won that particular round? I just have this vision of, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg going, oh, you almost got me on that third question there, Christian.
With the guests?
Yes.
I mean, not often. I mean, there are some guests with whom you get to know relatively well because you might interview them regularly, who you might have a bit of a chat with afterwards. But no, I mean, not really in that way. We have our own sort of, we call it a post-mortem in shorthand, after the programme, and talk about what worked and what didn't and what was good and what was bad and if that interview could have gone better, how might it have gone better, or, you know. But it's a few minutes at the end of the programme, and then we do another one in the morning before we start the day's news. At the beginning of our meeting, we have a little review of what happened the night before. So we think things through in terms of how to make them better. But it's relatively rare with guests. Because I also try not to become friends with politicians, because I think that's a difficult situation to be in. Yeah, it's good to be on good terms with them, and you want them to feel that they can trust you to some degree, that, you know, you're not there to sort of kill them. but you know, and you want to give them an opportunity to get their point of view across, while scrutinising it and giving them a grilling and holding them to account in a fair way. But I think there's, you know, I don't tend to, you know, socialise with politicians, because I think it would just make it a bit too difficult.
And what, again, to thinking of, you know, our experience, there's a type of interviewee that I really dread, and that is the professional cyclist, because it is just blood out of a stone, and they can really make you feel quite small. And I was at a round table once with Mark Cavendish, and this very earnest reporter from Belgium put his hand up and said, Mark, what are you most looking forward to this season? And then Mark Cavendish just stood up and went, not having to answer any more fucking questions like that, and walked off. And that was just such a like moment. Yeah. And that can be really where it gets pretty bad. So who represents the kind of pro cyclist where it could go either way? It's either been very dull or they're going to make you feel like really small.
I don't have to deal with much of that, to be honest, because most of the people who you talk to on the news want to be on the news or accept that it's their job that they've got to be on the news. The only ones who are really sort of reluctant interviewees are people in showbiz who might be doing, you know, an interview to promote a movie or a book or whatever it is, and they don't really want to do it, but they're being told that they have to do it by their publisher or the movie company or whatever it is, and they might get a bit sullen or uncooperative. And I can't really be bothered with that anymore. You know, I mean, if someone doesn't want to do an interview, then I'm not going to waste my time sort of trying to squeeze blood out of a stone. I would just wrap it up and go, you know, stop wasting my time. But I don't find that happens very much. It's very, very rare. And I think maybe it's the program that I do that, you know, it's got a reputation. People on the whole want to be on it. And even quite well-known people have a respect for it, I think. And so the smart Alec answer or the put down is just the worst possible look. I mean, I don't know what people think behaving like that, because you wouldn't behave like that in real life. I don't know what it is about. Maybe it's like trade journals or sort of, you know, because you're cycling journalists and you're talking to cyclists. There's almost sometimes a sort of a bit of a contempt, isn't there, I suppose? And it's so rude and so inappropriate. It's sort of, it would make me really angry.
Are there people you'd really, really like to interview who you just can't get close to? And I'm just thinking especially of just recently we had Tucker Carlson interviewing Vladimir Putin and then saying, oh, no one's even bothered else to actually interview him. Is that an interview you'd like to do? Or would that just terrify you?
No. I mean, I'd love to. I mean, you would always want to do the people who are the biggest people in the news. So, of course, the Russian president, the American president, they're always going to be sort of top of your list of people that you want to be talking to at any one point in time. The Chinese president, the Indian prime minister, you know, the people in power. And Tucker Carlson was talking nonsense and is not a journalist. So, you know, of course, everybody has been trying to interview Putin. And you know, I don't regard it as something that could never happen. You know, we've had the foreign minister on Channel 4 News in the last couple of years. It's not totally inconceivable that Putin will do an interview with, you know, normal media at some point in time. So it might happen. And you just kind of have to keep asking and seeing. I mean, it's much, much harder. You know, people in these sorts of positions just don't, on the whole, do it very much. And that applies to the American president as well. And they've got spokespeople and cabinet members to do all of that for them, especially with foreign media. I think most leaders these days tend, wherever they are, to speak to their home crowd ahead of foreign media.
And I'm sure they have very specific demands about what you can and cannot talk about before you go into any of these interviews. Do you feel obliged to respect that, or in the public interest, are you prepared to go off script?
No. I mean, there are no scripts and there's no rules. I mean, they might not want to talk about something, and you can't force anybody to talk about anything, but you certainly wouldn't sign up to an interview with Vladimir Putin on the basis that you can ask this and you can't ask that, or anyone. I mean, with government ministers on TV programs that you'll see every day, there's a sort of a unwritten code in that a minister will be doing an interview about a particular policy that it's their job to defend that day, or a particular bill. And so you invite them on, and the department will say, we're offering up the justice secretary on the new criminal justice bill. And the understanding will be that the majority of the interview will be about that topic, but there's nothing off limits. And usually that's why you'll hear, while you're with us, minister, I want to ask you about this other thing. And if anybody ever tries to say you can't talk about that, we say, well, we can't do the interview.
Have you ever kind of found yourself with almost kind of like a kind of cause de célèbre, like a person that you feel that you it's just your duty, or there's a fire lit underneath you to kind of pursue, go after, if you like. And I'm thinking in the way that in cycling media, David Walsh and also Paul Kimmage, you know, rewind your mind a good 15, well, what was it now, 20 years, David Walsh just went after Lance Armstrong tenaciously and found himself being sued and defended by his newspaper. And, you know, this guy Lance is trying to ruin this journalist's life. And it was just a dog with a bone. And it's ultimately thanks to someone like him that Armstrong ended up being, you know, taken to task and, you know, disgraced. Do you feel, you know, have you had that in your career where you're like, I need this person. This person is not allowed to get off the hook.
Well, I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm a presenter. So the programme does, but it's not necessarily my job to do that kind of doggedly following somebody around.
So who would be something that the programme's done that you've kind of worked on?
Well, if you think about how Channel 4 News was involved in exposing how Cambridge Analytica, the data company, worked, or the way Facebook was gathering data on everybody and using it, or the way we exposed the way the Trump campaign was operating a campaign to discourage ethnic minority voters from voting in the 2016 election. You know, these have been long-term investigations that have taken a long, long time, a lot of dogged investigative work over a long period of time, because we knew something was happening and we pursued it. But that tends to be our investigations unit rather than me. I mean, as the presenter of the news, I'm very much the front man and the person who does the interviewing and the holding to account. But I wouldn't want to take credit for that kind of the David Walsh. I'm not the David Walsh on Channel 4 News. We do have people like him who work for us, but they are they're a different breed, a different team. And it's a type of person.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, if you've met people like that, you know, that they are an amazing type of journalist that is very dogged and just, they might not get a story out for months and months and months, but they're beavering away. And it's a very expensive business. So there's fewer and fewer of them now, because you need to have the kind of news organizations who can afford to have those people working for them, or freelancers who are able to make money other ways while also digging away at something.
Well, of course, that's the real point at the moment, isn't it? You talk about it's an expensive business producing these. Now, Channel 4 is having a bit of a torrid time of it at the moment. Perhaps you could bring us speed. What state is it in? And there's a fast forward plan. There's changes afoot. What's happening, and what's your thoughts on it?
I mean, to be honest, that's all sort of beyond me. I mean, I just do what I do, which is the news. I mean, in general, it's a terrible year for TV. You know, there's a real advertising crunch. There is less money in the business right now, and sort of recovering from COVID and the economic downturn is really, really hard, because advertising is one of the, you know, most directly affected things in any economic downturn. And we're in recession right now, so it's tough. And Channel 4 is going through cuts. It's all very difficult. And, you know, also sort of a change in the way they are sort of structured. But that's way beyond what I do. And in a way, we're quite lucky on the news, and that we can just concentrate on what we do, which is tell stories, hold people to account, find things out, make trouble, and not really worry about all the corporate stuff. And as long as we carry on doing what we do and keeping ourselves relevant, and, you know, have people watch our stuff, whether it's on the internet or on TV, that's all I worry about.
I was going to say, is it sort of like a wonderful, you know, piece of serendipitous timing that the market, and we see this as well, you know, the media market is in a slump because of ads revenue. But this year, in terms of political news, you've got the kind of marquee event. You've got the Tour de France of political news. You've got two elections, one at home.
Well, more than two. I mean, you've got elections all over the world.
Yeah, but
I've just come back from Iran, you know, where we were covering an election of sorts there. not a traditional election, yeah, in that the candidates were very limited. But yeah, you've got elections all, you know, in India, all over Africa, Asia. It's a weird year for elections all over the world, and at a time when democracy is really up against it in lots of parts of the world. So it's an amazing year. But yeah, as you say, you know, the two big ones in terms of British media will be the US and British elections.
Yeah.
And we expect them to come pretty much at the same time now, which is going to be, you know, a real challenge, I think, for journalists and viewers. Because I don't know how much appetite people are going to have come October, November for loads and loads of politics on both sides of the pond. So we've got to try and work really, really hard to make it relevant and interesting and informative rather than just noisy. You know, because the danger, particularly with the American election, is that it just becomes the same old noise between the same two candidates. And it's dirty, divisive, depressing, distressing, all the D's.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be a tough one, I think, but we'll try our best.
Is it an exciting time nonetheless, though? And I'm thinking, like, is it also, yeah, a point where, you know, you get your press card, and I'm assuming you have a Trilby that you put your press card in, and your suitcase, your attaché case, and you say to your family, "See you guys, I am just going to be living underneath my news desk now for the next, you know, however many weeks or months, because it's just 24/7 type development," especially as the way that, you know, I think lots of media outlets have kind of curated things like elections. And obviously the mind boggles about how they handle this stuff in the States, where it's just the ticker tape sort of running and running and running. But yeah, do you find yourself both being like very excited, but also like maybe a bit trepidatious, like, blimey, this is going to be a lot of work?
I mean, most more excited than trepidatious. I mean, it's going to be very, very busy, and it already is. And I think because I decided quite consciously that I don't really want to just do the news, which is why I did Strictly, and why I do things like the Bike Ride, and I get involved in charity, and try and have a bit more to my life than just chasing around after politicians and covering events around the world. So yeah, I mean, but it's already been like that as far as home is concerned, and sort of, do I have a suitcase and am I here and there and everywhere? Yeah, that's already the case, but partly because of all the strange choices I've made. So, you know, if I think about this year, I've been away on tour, I've been doing the news, obviously we've been concentrating hugely on the Middle East and events in Gaza and Israel. I've been to Iran last week. I'm going to Korea next week. So it's very up and down and all over the place. And God knows when I'm going to do any cycle training.
Now, I feel like so far everything we talked about has been incredibly lighthearted. So I wanted to ask a heavy-hitting question now. So I asked ChatGPT what I should ask you, but specifically what Jon Snow would ask you if you were on a fictitious Jon Snow podcast in a moment of unlikely Jon Snow levity. And ChatGPT said, "Considering Jon Snow's reputation for his serious demeanour, a humorous question might still have an element of wit or dry humour. Here's a suggestion. So Krishnan, we all know you're a serious journalist, but if you were let loose to star in your own slapstick comedy film, what kind of character would you play? And what hilarious mishaps do you think might befall you?"
What character would I play? Oh, that's a good one. I mean, you instantly think about sort of Carry-On films, don't you? I suppose I would want to be the doctor, having been the failed medic, because I was going to be a doctor until I became a journalist and I got a place at medical school. I suppose I'd want to be the sort of the slightly chaotic and incompetent doctor in one of the Carry-On films.
Excellent. And but I also feel there is, and I do mean this, there is a serious element to this question, and no, I feel like podcast at the moment, we'd be remiss to not touch on the subject of AI. Where do you see AI, or how do you see it affecting the news? How does it affect your day-to-day already? You know, do you use it for research? Are you being told, we want you to use more of this, it's a time-saving tool? Do you see it as actually potentially quite sinister? How do you kind of see it playing out?
I don't know is the honest answer. I mean, we are starting to use it a little bit, technically rather than in terms of research. Don't use it for research, partly because most of the AI tools that are available right now are not right up to the minute. So they're not that much use for news. They're dependent on what data they've got access to. So, but we are using it in terms of some of the technical things we're doing. We have a director on Channel 4 News who is very, very clever and very, very techie, and he is using or looking at how to use AI in automating some of our technical processes. But obviously, AI is going to have a huge impact in what we do and is already potentially a real problem. I mean, right now we are seeing the ability of AI to create video, fake video, dependent on you just saying, show me an image of a politician caught with his trousers down in my street. And AI will do that literally if you want. So there's going to be lots of video out there that we can't verify and we don't know is real. And I think at times like now in the Middle East, when you've got a lot of war video that's coming out captured on mobile phones, it's going to be harder and harder to know whether that video is real or whether it's been created by AI. Now, at the moment, the tools are a bit unsubtle and you can usually spot AI video. You know, the limbs aren't quite right, the number of fingers aren't quite right, you know, all that kind of stuff gives it away. But it's not going to be long before video created by AI is pretty indistinguishable from real video. And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge to what we do. And we're already seeing it in the US election. You know, there have been images of Donald Trump created with black voters that we saw in the last few days that were faked and created by AI. So I think that the fake news problem is going to get worse because of AI. And what I'm hoping that means is that it's actually quite good for trusted news brands, because you will only know that what you're seeing is real and can be trusted when you see it on Channel 4 News or on the Channel 4 News feed, rather than if you just see a piece of video or other trusted news brands, obviously. But, you know, when you just see a bit of video on X or Instagram or whatever it is, you just don't know what it is. That, I think that's the biggest immediate challenge. And then, obviously, there are challenges within the industry in terms of jobs and writing. You know, it's not going to be long before you can just say to AI, write me the script for what happened today on such and such a court case, and it will do it. And if you can say, now put it to pictures, it will do it. So those are all things that are currently done by human journalists who are skilled and experienced and take judgments. It's not going to be long before that can be done by a computer. So what that means for our newsroom, I don't really know yet, because it hasn't. We're not quite there. But yeah, it poses all sorts of problems. And the biggest one is going to be, can you trust it? You know, I've got a Tesla and it does. I don't have the full automatic driving, but I've got some of the automatic driving skills. And even though I know it's very, very clever and it's based on millions of driving interactions, I still don't really trust it. If I put it on, I'm still scared of it. So I don't think I'm going to trust AI news when it comes on. And I'm sure it will come on quite soon. You know, you will very soon have a news channel available on the internet, which is entirely AI. You know, there'll be some very good looking person with a very smooth voice showing you images, some of which will be real, some of which won't be.
And already are you finding that you're having to double check the content that's coming in because you're just frightened that that video might not be real or that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been happening for years, because fake video has obviously been a problem for a long time. Or the using video from one conflict and pretending or passing it off as from another one has been a real problem on social media for many years. So we do quite a lot to try and verify video that we haven't generated ourselves or hasn't come from a trusted source. And that's just normal journalistic practice. But it's going to just become a lot harder, I think.
But in general, with technology and AI and the Trump elections and things, would you consider yourself an optimistic person about the future? Or does all this stuff that's coming along kind of terrify you?
I am generally quite optimistic, I think, about all of these things, because I, you know, AI is also a very useful tool, and it's about us staying in touch with it, us regulating it, and keeping a sense of perspective with it. And I think there will be all sorts of ways in which it's a good thing. It's the same argument over, do you give your kid a mobile phone? You know, yes, there are all sorts of things that are worrying about having a teenager with a mobile phone, but on the whole, personally, I would rather be able to get in touch with my son, make sure that he's safe, be able to track him, see what he's watching and all that kind of stuff, than not. So I think we've got to try and stay optimistic about all of these things, because they are supposed to be progress. And it's up to us as to whether we turn them into progress or not.
I feel that that's an incredibly good note to end on, and leads me into want to ask you just one more question. There's two rockets taking off to terraform Mars or take us wherever we need to go, because the planet is on fire. I know you're optimistic, but things aren't looking good. One of them is piloted by Elon Musk, and the other one is Bill Gates. Whose rocket are you getting on? Bearing in mind they've both built their rockets, I would suggest that Bill might cure malaria, but Elon possibly has built a few more in his time. You know, indirectly, he made your Tesla.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a strong view on it, I have to say, because I use Microsoft products at work and I drive a Tesla on my way to get there. So, we'll have to take that judgment at the time.
I like that. Impartial even about global survival. That's amazing.
Well, Christian, thank you so much for joining us. I'm aware we've gone way over our allotted time, but it's been absolutely fascinating. And sorry to have strayed so far away from cycling, but it's not often we get a chance to talk to someone with so much insight in so many things. So,
always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really interesting for us, and I know our listeners will have loved it. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I consider myself a regular now.
Christian Gurumurthy, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again, Christian, for coming on the show. I hope that won't be the last time. A true gentleman, a great cyclist, I think, if he's doing this every year. It does make me think. I haven't ridden to Paris from London, and I certainly haven't done it in 24 hours. I have done some quite long rides, but I know you're a man who does a lot of riding because you have to, as the editor of a cyclist magazine. Was thinking, Pete, what would be your longest, or maybe your kind of hardest, most, dare I say, hellish time on a bicycle? There must have been a few.
Most hellish ride? That's a tricky one. But I think I always think back to the Dartmoor Classic.
Oof. You said it all with the words Dartmoor and Classic.
And it was one of those days where it was horizontal rain for the entire day. And Dartmoor, if anyone's been up there, you know it's very high up and it's quite flat once you're up there. So there was a headwind that made it feel like you were climbing a 10% climb, crawling along. And I can recall looking behind me to see a queue of people about a mile long on my tail, all basically drafting behind me. So I spent my time nudging my elbow out, trying to make people come round, but nobody would come round. And eventually I got to a stop. As I recall, I was doing the gold ride, which is the longest one. And I think at the first rest stop, I decided to swap to the bronze level one, whatever it was, because by this point I was suffering from mild hypothermia. And yes, so yes, weather-wise, that was about as bad as it got. How about you, James? Talk me through your toughest ride.
There was one really, it wasn't even a proper, it wasn't like a fun ride. I didn't sign up for it. It had no special name. It was just a ride with actually our colleague, Rob Milton, our art director. We went out for, I don't know, just, it was going to be like, right, we'll do 100K. We were obviously champing at the bit back in those days. We weren't jaded cyclists just yet. So got up early doors.
Well, I remember this. I think I gave you this route, didn't I?
Maybe you did. It was out around London, out from London, and it went out into Essex. And at some point, it just got so cold. And then it started raining. And I just remember I was wearing a pair of Defeat or seal skins, kind of those woolen gloves that promise to be waterproof with a liner, which is all well and good, except for gloves are never waterproof. Don't let anyone tell you gloves are fully waterproof, because they have a cuff. So unless you're duct taping them on, they're always going to leak. So the water is going to get in somewhere. And then because they're this kind of wool, then eventually it absorbs some of the water. So I've just got these mittens of just cold creeping death, which I can barely pull the brake levers with. And then, of course, typically Rob gets a flat. And so we have to pull over. And this, again, was in the days where I just thought CO2 canisters were such a pro thing to have, as opposed to even deigning to use the fools that use mini pumps. And so I got out these CO2 canisters with our shaking little hands. And I was like, that's okay, mate, I'll change it for you. And then in letting off this thing, it just welded itself to my glove because it did the discharge. It got really, really cold. The glove's really wet. So then my hands just stuck to the CO2 canister. And it was just miserably cold. And the strangest part of it was, at some point we got lost on a housing estate. And on the housing estate was this little like whiny noise that came closer and closer. And there's a guy on the moped, and he wasn't wearing a helmet. And he pulled up and he said something like, what are you doing around here? And it was none other, I shit you not, than Dappy from N-Dubs on a scooter going around this estate. Almost like we're hallucinating. And anyway, long story short, we got home. Eventually, I got a sort of phone call from Rob hours later, and he said that it had taken him about 45 minutes to get in his house because he couldn't get his keys out of his back pocket because he couldn't reach around. And eventually, he had to ask a neighbour who was coming in to fish them out for him.
To reach into his pocket. Yeah. Okay. Oh, well. See, this is the joy of cycling. No other sports really do. You know, you don't get this in squash, do you?
No.
You know people go, oh, do you remember that time we could barely feel our hands afterwards because we were so tired and miserable after a game of squash.
But could you imagine how good squash could be if they had those kind of climber chambers that they used to test Arctic jackets? And so at different points in time, the conditions within that glass box just changed into like biblical weather.
Yeah, and they just suddenly turn on the rain shower halfway through a game just to add a bit, you know. Yeah, so you're splashing around inside your box. And then suddenly the snow would start afterwards. Okay. I think we may have hit upon something here. Climate squash. There you go. That's the next Olympic sport.
Yeah, no, I definitely sign up to that. Well, Pete, it's been a pleasure. But for now, this has been the Cyclist Magazine podcast. And we'll come back to you in another 2 weeks.
Thank you for having them. And I'm off to sort out the Christmas bonuses right now.
Excellent. Well, I mean, you're going to need 9 months to count them out, I would have thought.
All the piles of pennies, you mean? Yes, that's exactly right.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that Cyclist isn't just a podcast. No, Cyclist is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist magazine subscription offers.